this show is supported by listeners like you at patreon.com/KevinRothrock, where you can sign up to receive stickers or coffee mugs, depending on how much cold, hard cash you're willing to shell out. Howdy, folks. Welcome to another episode of The Russia Guy. I'm your host, Kevin Rothrock, and I'm releasing this show on the podcast's third anniversary. It's the 114th episode, and the show premiered on this day in 2017. The first couple of episodes no longer exist, in fact, because I actually deleted them when I was still debating whether I would bother paying for hosting space online. I used to host this show at SoundCloud. Earlier this year, I moved it to Buzzsprout. Very interesting names, both these websites. But yes, anyway, those early days are lost forever. It's not a great loss, though, because I only started interviewing guests several months into this show. At first, I used it mostly as a kind of audio blog, but it wasn't until later that I decided to turn it into an excuse to talk to people who otherwise I'd only befriend or be enemy on Twitter. If you follow me on Twitter, you'll know that the persona I put forward there isn't very pleasant. And that's certainly a side of me, but I've consciously used this podcast as somewhere I try to be a bit kinder and where I try to talk a bit less and listen a bit more. So on today's show, I spoke to someone I've sparred with repeatedly on Twitter, but who's always shown me a bit more decency than I'm accustomed to getting from my supposed virtual opponents. I talked to Brian McDonald, the head of the online Russia desk at the English language edition of Russia Today, or RT. The government-run news agency you undoubtedly already know. I suspect that some listeners, or more likely, some people who don't listen to this show but might find out later about this episode, will object to my decision to publish an interview with Brian. Earlier this year, I offended several people when I ran an interview in my Medusa podcast, The Naked Pravda, with libertarian activist Mikhail Svetov, who incidentally was a guest on this show many years ago. From Medusa, I talked to him about his views on Black Lives Matter, protests and riots in America, and race relations. People accused me of active harm and spreading misinformation and so on. I've learned since then that I am not interested in these debates about platforming, as it's called. If you don't want to listen to Brian McDonald talk about journalism or Russian politics, just don't listen to this episode. Don't share it with your friends. Don't platform it. I don't care if you do or if you don't. I knew enough about Brian before I invited him onto the show to decide that I wanted to hear his story. And I'm happy I did. Now, here it is. The first question I had is just a kind of general thing. You live in
Krasnodar.
You live in Krasnodar.
I live in Krasnodar, yeah.
So you live in Krasnodar, but you're an Irishman. Can you explain for listeners, like, how did you go from being an Irishman in Ireland to an Irishman in Krasnodar?
Very simple reason. As some of your older listeners will remember, the Irish economy basically collapsed in 2008 and 2009 after the financial crash. And as you also know, as most of your listeners who are interested in the media will know, that the media itself has collapsed during the same time period as well. When I worked in Dublin, you know, in the 2000s, late 90s, there were numerous newspapers that don't exist anymore. There were newspapers that still exist, probably had three times more staff then. The staff were paid higher wages. So basically what happened is that the bottom fell out of the industry in Ireland. And what I find astonishing, Kevin, is that my journalism school, the class in my college in 1999, 1998, it was 26 or something in each year, as I remember. And I think only three of us are still involved in journalism, as far as I know, three or four. Now, could you imagine going to a medical school class from 1998? How many are involved in medicine? I guess all of them, bar a couple. A law class. You know what I mean? That just shows you what's happened to the media.
What have they gone into? Do you know your ex-classmates?
I'm not really in touch with a lot of them, but I know some of them have gone into PR, which is the main thing they go into.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is running a pub, as far as I know.
That sounds nice. In Ireland. That sounds nice.
You know, probably. Another guy is, he went a bit cuckoo. I know, because he's from the same city as me, and I don't think he does anything. But, you know, but basically, yeah, I mean, like, I'm just saying, like, that if you went to possibly any other discipline at third level, I mean, architects, accountants, it would be unfathomable that, you know, 80 or 90% of them would not be still in that discipline 20 years later, like after going to the trouble of studying it for a couple of years, you know, or a few years. So, I mean, like, You know, now, obviously, it can happen with arts graduates because, I mean, just because you study Russian studies doesn't mean you're going to go and live in Russia, for example. But in a course that's geared towards a specific profession or trade, it'd be amazing. I mean, like, imagine going to, like, 50 engineering students and finding out that they were all working as, you know, artisan chefs or something now. You know, it just wouldn't be, you know. So what I'm trying to say is that's what happened. The bottom just fell out of it and there was literally no work. And what work there was extremely poorly paid. I did some work in the early part of 2010 for a British newspaper I won't name. And they just treated me really badly and didn't pay me what was agreed to. And I just got totally disheartened with the whole thing. So I ended up in Russia. Other friends of mine emigrated to places like Canada, Australia at the time, the Middle East, South Korea. I had a chance to go and work in Nevada in America, actually, in Las Vegas, through an old contact I knew from Dublin. And I think about a month before I went to Russia, I turned down the Vegas thing. And I went to Russia like most guys, following a girl I'd met in Berlin. But I didn't expect to stay for so long. But how did I end up in Krasnodar is very simple, total simple reason for that. My work with ORT requires me to be in Russia, basically, because I cover Russia. And also it's a time zone issue. And I don't want to live in Moscow because I don't like the climate. It's a very, very big city, as you know, having been there many times. Some people really love big city energy. I'm not sure that I do. I find it very inconvenient when you got to sit in the car for 2 hours to, you know, go buy a bunch of bananas or something, you know. And I just don't like that lifestyle. I don't like the climate. I think I said that already. I mean,
bears repeating.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know if your listeners obviously all are interested in Russia, so you will know that. I think it was in 2017 in December, there was only 6 minutes of daylight in the whole month, of sunlight in the whole month in Moscow. I was there on the 2nd of June of 2018, the year of the World Cup, and it snowed on the 2nd of June. I mean, it's catastrophic. I was in Moscow actually this July for a week, and the sun did not shine for a single moment in the whole week I was there. Unless it was shining at 6 in the morning and I didn't notice because I was asleep or something. And it rained every day, and it was about, I don't know in Fahrenheit, but it was about 14 or 15 degrees Celsius in July. I mean, that's about 50 degrees Fahrenheit in July. So yeah, I just don't like it. And also, it's expensive, as you know, to live there. There's no prospect of, you know, home ownership or anything like that in Moscow unless you've got a very, you know, unless you want to live outside the MCAT. So there's a variety of reasons why I'm in Krasnodar as opposed to Moscow, where everybody else is. I also think it's interesting that in the United States, I understand Russia is a much more centralized country than the United States, but the fact that all the correspondents covering Russia are based out of Moscow, except for one or two, there's one guy that works for the AFP in St. Petersburg, I know. I find it a little bit unhealthy, to be honest with you. I mean, could you imagine if all the journalists covering America all lived in New York? It'd be weird, wouldn't it?
Sometimes it feels like they do, but yeah, I know what you mean.
They all live in one street in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, maybe. But I'm just saying that, you know, I just think it's a little bit, I understand that Russia's far more centralized. I understand about budgets. I understand that a lot of the foreign correspondents have accommodation provided to them as part of their contract because that goes back to the Soviet era. But, and I understand it's expensive to travel, and in Russia especially. I mean, I'm sure you know, Kevin, that there's no really discounted train tickets here, for example. So, like, for me to go to Moscow, you'll never get a ticket for less than $100 ever, you know, each way. 200 return, flights can be a bit cheaper. Yes, I understand that people don't have unlimited money, but I do feel that being down here gives me a little bit of an advantage on, you know, let's call it middle Russia and how middle Russia thinks. I think that when you're in Moscow, you can get a little bit too caught up in the well-off liberal bubble. And I think that can in some way skew your worldview, that you think that, I'm not saying everybody falls into this trap because a lot of people in Moscow, reporters in Moscow are very smart people, but some of them I find fall into the trap that they think that the people they speak to every day who are in central Moscow, who are more liberal than the rest of Russia, are representative of what most of Russia really wants. And I do think that's a little bit of a problem in media coverage of Russia. A little bit.
And so when you do arrive in Russia, and I imagine, is it before you go to Krasnodar, but like at what point do you actually begin working as a journalist in Russia? Is your first job as a journalist in Russia with RT, or do you have other positions before that? Or
I got out of it completely. I went to Khabarovsk in Vladivostok in the Far East, and I ended up running. I started an English school with a Russian guy called Andrei, and we set it up. And well, he kind of had it already, but it was a tiny concern, and we rejigged it, and that was a bit of fun. I mean, but after about a year or two, I had enough of it. Now I really did. I had enough of it. I mean, it was, you know, because I was so incredibly poor after the 2008 crash, I wanted to make some money. And Russia, as you know, at the time was booming. It was a time when the ruble was about 28 or 9 to the dollar, and the price of oil was over $100 a barrel, and Russia had good relations with the West, and economic growth was 7 or 8% a year. And yeah, I thought I was going to make a bit of money out of this, and that's why I did it. Funny that people the school was sold on to came from Yakutia, and it closed down about 5 or 6 months after I left, because the only reason people were basically going to it is because there was a foreigner there. So there were foreign, I brought in some other foreigners obviously as well. So, you know, that was it, you know. And so then I finished up with that, got a small bit of money out of it, not as much as I would have thought I would have. And I went back to Ireland. And I said, I want to get back into journalism, which is my primary education. And the situation hadn't improved from 2008. If anything, there were even fewer jobs than there were in 2010. The salaries were nothing like they had been in 2006, 2007. Dublin had become more expensive to live in. And blah. And then Ukraine happened, Kevin. And what happened with Ukraine was that I had spent a little bit of time in Ukraine when I was in Khabarovsk, because I used to go there to do visa runs, because I was on 3 month visas basically at the time. Well, actually, then in the beginning, and then I got a 1 year visa. And I used to go to Kyiv to do my visa runs because somebody I knew had a contact at the embassy in Kyiv. And because I spent that time in Ukraine in 2010, 2011, 2012, I also visited Crimea in 2013, just before the Maidan, by the way, when it was still part of Ukraine. And that was purely because I'm interested and I wanted to see it. That was all, just the history and everything. I went to the Levadia Palace, and I went to, you know, the Beli Dacha and all that kind of stuff, you know, in Yalta. And anyway, so the thing was just that there was nothing happening in Ireland. I mean, and I just didn't know what to do. And then Ukraine started, and I wrote an op-ed about Ukraine. Don't even know why I did it. A newspaper I hadn't worked for previously in Ireland, the Mail, the Irish Daily Mail, they agreed to take the piece, and then the editor didn't really like the tone of it, and then it got spiked, and I obviously got a bit angry about it. You know, he said that he thought it was now what I was predicting in this article was that if the Maidan continued, it could lead to a civil war in Ukraine. And I did say, by the way, that Russia would be involved in starting the civil war, because Russia would quite obviously, you know, back the eastern areas against, you know, what they perceived as the Western encroachment. But at the time, the rhetoric in Western Europe was that this Maidan can only be a good thing, that nothing bad can come from this Maidan. You know, we're spreading European prosperity, you know, into Ukraine. And look, he didn't run it anyway. And I, at some point a few months later, I wrote something else, and it was rejected by another newspaper. And this time I just got tired of it. And then I placed it with RT, I think, or I might have not. They might not have run that exact piece. And look, you can say what you want about RT, but they've been very good to me, and they've allowed me to, you know, write about what I want, and that's it. And, you know, I mean, like, and they were there at the time. I was looking for work at the time, and that's basically it. The other option I would have had, maybe I could have come to Moscow and tried to work for the Moscow Times. But, Kevin, I had written to the Moscow Times in 2011, I think, or 2012, offering to write something for them about Khabarovsk. I forget who the editor was at the time, but the editor wrote back to me and said, yeah, please do it. We'd love to run it, but we can't pay you. So me having been a professional journalist, like at that stage, I mean, I started writing for my local newspaper when I was 15. So by that stage, I've been doing it for about 15 years. I wasn't going to write for free, basically. You know, I mean, no more than a professional plumber would come around and sort out your sink and not ask for payment, you know? So, yeah, that was all. Now, I understand that some young guys coming out of university who are looking for training will be willing to do an unpaid internship at something like the Moscow Times. I understand that completely. But at the stage I was at, I was already in my 30s. I wasn't going to start working for free, basically. That's how I saw it.
And so what your role at RT right now, like, what are you doing? What's your kind of your work regime? You said that you know, you're the head of the Russia desk, but like, what does that mean in practice?
It's a very small team, Kevin. It's the notorious Johnny Tickle, who is a real person, by the way. I know you've disputed that with that name.
What is that, a real sir? Is that his real surname? Can you explain that one?
Yeah, it's a Lancastrian surname in the north of England.
His name is Mr. Tickle.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, I mean he seems like a very nice guy, but so I apologize for laughing at his name. I'm sure my last name Rothrock is amusing to many people too. So
yeah, but English people have some weird names. I worked in London years ago with a guy called Mr. Parrot.
Okay,
you know, it was, you know, you just do that. I mean, there was a guy. Oh, I worked with a Mr. Turtle.
That's pretty good.
In England.
That's pretty good.
Years and years ago. Thomas Turtle was his name.
It's even alliterative? Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he was from the East End of London, the Cockney guy, you know, uh-huh. Thomas Turtle. And that was his name, Mr. Turtle. I mean, like, but they have some weird names in England, yeah, that are, you know, descriptive. Anyway, the notorious Johnny Tickle, you know, or Jonathan Tickle, and myself, basically, and one Russian guy called Yuri, we essentially run the Russia desk. Now, you're saying, why has RT not got a bigger Russia desk? Because it should be covering Russia. We're constantly trying to expand. But the problem is, Kevin, that as you're fully aware, there's a very small pool of people who can write well in English and also understand Russian. A very small pool of people. And then there's a very even smaller pool that would probably want to work for RT. So if I'm honest. So that's like, makes it hard to recruit people. Now, bringing some people in the next couple of weeks, it's been a hard process to try and whittle them down, but also because I don't want to go back to the situation of like where it looks like it's been written by, you know, an 11-year-old who speaks English as their fourth language or something, you know. So if I want to bring someone in, I'd rather bring nobody in than bring somebody who's not going to bring value, if you know what I mean, that kind of way. So if anyone's listening and looking for a job, don't hesitate to email Kevin and he'll pass on the details. You know, but that's basically it. Like, so at the moment, it's the two of us. Obviously, there's then Russian staff writers who contribute to the Russia section to varying degrees, breaking news and stuff like that. But the RT online operation is probably much smaller than people would realize, I think. You know, but it's there's some idea that RT is just like, you know, has this endless money pit, you know, but not really. If you look at how many different languages RT is broadcasting in, how many different, now whether it should have television or not, I mean, that's not for me to decide. But obviously broadcasting television costs a lot of money. Obviously it needs a lot of translators and stuff like that. So even though it looks like RT has a huge amount of money, you know, it's certainly like, it's not as, when you see what they're trying to do, how spread they are, it's not necessarily a huge amount, you know.
I wanted to pivot away from your biography to a question about Navalny, because I know that you and I have kind of gone back and forth about this a little bit on Twitter. And I wanted to know, so you whenever, when people, I mean, right now, there's obviously a lot of speculation about who's responsible for what appears to have been, you know, this chemical weapons attack against him. And one thing that I know you've brought up, and apparently it's a position that kind of resonates with Russian officials as well, is this notion that he just isn't, and I mean, that he isn't popular enough to warrant something as egregious as a, you know, an assassination attempt, essentially?
No, I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that at all. I don't agree. Russian officials can say that, but I don't agree with that at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think the problem with Navalny, Kevin, is that, in my opinion, I can see why people in Moscow would see him first and foremost as a opposition politician, because Moscow people go to his protests. Well, I mean, journalists working in Moscow, they go to his protests, which attract reasonable crowds, and they could see him as a political figure. But down here and outside of Moscow, I think he's better known as effectively Russia's most important investigative journalist. That's how I would see it. I mean, if you look at, like, if you're not in Moscow and you're not attending protests in central Moscow, you're more likely to know Navalny from his internet videos, obviously. You know, and his internet videos are largely the most popular ones anywhere about corruption and about investigating corruption. I mean, I think the most popular one is the Medvedev video. Correct me if I'm wrong. So if you're living in a place like Krasnodar or Krasnoyarsk or Khabarovsk or Irkutsk, that's what they know Navalny as. And don't forget that Moscow is only 8% of Russia. So I would say that Navalny's political appeal, whether it's 2% or 4% or 3% or whatever, isn't really relevant at all to this. So I disagree with Russian officials on that. I just think that the idea that he was poisoned because of his political activity, which is the focus of the British and American media, is what I don't agree with. I think it's far more likely it happened because of his journalistic work. That's what I think. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. But I just think that he's done so many investigations into people now that he's obviously got hundreds of enemies, or dozens of enemies at least anyway. And a lot of these are very powerful people with access to dangerous stuff, you know? And with friends in high places and friends in the security services and friends in the mafia and all kinds of things, you know? And I just feel that's where I feel the focus. I wouldn't like to be in the same box as the officials. I'm not just saying, he's not worth poisoning because he's not popular enough. I'm just saying that I would feel that the reason he's been poisoned might be more to do with his journalistic investigative activities than his political activities. That's what I mean.
Yeah, no, I certainly think that there's an argument to be had for that. But at the same time, I don't know, I feel also like emphasizing his polls, his polling, his trust polling rating, which is, I guess, like usually when people talk about 2 or 3 or 4%, they're referring to the latest Levada or some poll that like did the trust score, where Putin usually scores between like, you know, in the high 20s or the kind of somewhere in the 30s, something like that. And Navalny's kind of there alongside people like Shoigu or Zhirinovsky or, you know, other like these establishment figures. So it's, in some respect, it's impressive that he managed to break through, you know, at all, given that like he's not a elected or appointed official. But even like, so if perhaps it's correct that his investigative journalism is what perpetrated the attack against him. But at the same time, like, I guess like my question to you would be, is it possibly too dismissive to just say that he's not really viewed as a politician elsewhere, given that like he did, I mean, I know this was before the Crimean annexation, which changed Russian politics in major ways, but he, you know, he did win more than a quarter of the vote in the Moscow mayoral race in 2013. And just in these elections over the last weekend, his allies or his like associates or aides or whatever, you know, got elected to city council seats in Novosibirsk, I think in Tomsk. And so it's clear that he's like, he is.
No, I hear what you're saying, but okay, I'll answer your question in two parts here. I'm actually not being dismissive of Navalny. I know I can see why you would think I am being, but the point is that if we don't use Levada, what other metric do we have? I mean, Levada is an independent pollster. It is it has received Western funding in the past. There's no way it's under the Kremlin's control. But what other metric do we have? I mean, okay, in the United States, and by the way, in America, you use polling all the time as well. I mean, every time I look on Twitter, someone's saying Biden is 3 points ahead in Pittsburgh or Pennsylvania, or Trump is 2 points ahead in Florida. I mean, it's used in other countries as well. About the second part, what was the second part? Sorry, you were saying, I got a bit too excited about Navalny.
You mean the bit about his allies getting,
the election. Yeah, but here's another point as well, Kevin. The far right party, Rodina, won seats as well in Tambov at the weekend. And like, you know, Navalny's aides won, I think, 7 seats in total in 2 different cities, in Tomsk and Novosibirsk. But, you know, the far right party actually won control of the council in Tambov. Like, they won control of it. And there's not a word about it in, little word about it from, you know, English language correspondence. I mean, like, what Navalny's team did is great and well done to them, and fair play to them and everything. May they make more breakthroughs in other cities. But what I feel is that his influence in politics is exaggerated in Western coverage, is all I'm trying to say. I mean, like Rodna, who are a bunch of nutters, basically, anti-Semitic party for a start, they won a whole city. Like, at the end of the day, like, even though Navalny's aides won these seats, I mean, United Russia still controls the council in Novosibirsk. That's a fact. I mean, okay, they didn't win an overall majority, but I think 3 independents went to their side to give them a working majority. So, you know, like, and I understand, by the way, that Navalny's team are up against a lot of oppression, a lot of problems or things are put in their way. They're forced off ballots. They're harassed. They're intimidated. I understand all that. And I take all that into account. But I also make the point that 10 years ago, when everything was about television here, it was easy to say, it's because they're not on TV. But to be quite honest with you, Kevin, like, nobody under 35 that I know here is watching TV anymore. They're all watching the internet, like YouTube, like in America, it's the very same thing. And the Kremlin does not control the internet. So what's the explanation for that then? Why is Navalny not, you know, cleaning up amongst, you know, people in their 20s? That's just my point. I mean, like, I can't answer, but I'm just saying, like, that I just feel that, you know, this meme or whatever you want to call it, or this thing that he's the opposition leader, which he's not, has overshadowed the fact that, in my opinion, what is more interesting about Navalny is his investigative journalism. I find that more interesting in a way than his political impact, because he's definitely upset people more with his journalism than with his politics.
Well, I wanted to turn to comparisons between RFERL and RT, because I know this is something that comes up not infrequently when having kind of media conversations about, certainly when talking about, I mean, my impression at least is that when talking to people who either are at RT or maybe would defend RT, or at least argue that it's not so peculiar, they would say that, well, the United States, for instance, and obviously the U.S. isn't alone here, but the United States, for instance, funds media outlets that have sort of focused, they focus their audiences abroad and their coverage abroad and so on. And Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty is like, you know, the biggest one that the U.S. funds, as far as I know, although maybe they have, I don't know, Voice of America, where that stands now. But
Voice of America as well. And Yeah.
But so like RFERL is kind of like the more respected one, I would say. VOA has kind of gone downhill, at least in the kind of like enlightened perceptions.
When was it ever uphill?
Well, I mean, like, it's become more partisan, at least, because I know VOA has run a few puff pieces on I think the Trumps or something like that. So I know that at least among certain people, it's no longer considered intelligent to praise VOA. But RFERL, I would say, still has a pretty good reputation among, you know, your kind of average Russia expert in the West. And I'll say that I find that RFERL's content is usually pretty good. And I know, you know, several reporters, I've interviewed several reporters there, and I have a pretty good opinion of their work. But I know that some people will argue that you know, they're basically the same thing. What's your response to the defense that actually RFERL has, you know, an editorial firewall, and that they, you know, they occasionally even investigate the U.S. officials and get information that Washington, for instance, is, you know, hesitant to share through Freedom of Information Act requests? Like, it doesn't seem to me that RT does that kind of coverage when it comes to Russia. Like, how do you respond to that?
Okay, first of all, as I understand, RFERL, Radio, we'll call it Radio Liberty for the sake of argument, okay? As I understand, Radio Liberty's mandate is not to cover the United States itself. It's to cover Eurasia or whatever, or Europe and Asia. The problem I have with the comparisons with Radio for Europe is that it very clearly says on their website of their parent, which is called the USAGM now, it used to be called the BBG, that they are charter bound to reflect United States foreign policy interests, and they are charter bound to provide a surge capacity for the United States government in times of foreign policy crisis abroad. I think you can see that happening in Belarus, for example, right now, where they've been very, very active. They call it, I think, Svoboda there, don't they, in Belarusian, you know. So, yeah, I mean, we saw it at the Maidan. Now, I don't have a particular problem with Radio Free Europe or Radio Liberty itself. The problem I have is that I don't, first of all, the thing about it is that, as well, another thing I can't understand is that, according to their own messaging, they're supposed to bring media coverage to places that don't have sufficient media freedom. Isn't that right? That's what they say. But then why do they have English language correspondents, for example, in Moscow and Kyiv? I mean, who is that aimed at? Because who speaks English in Russia? I mean, or Ukraine? I mean, they speak obviously Russian or some Ukrainian. And so I find it very hard to understand why they have English language correspondents, because that coverage is obviously not aimed at Russia or Ukraine. It's aimed at back home, obviously, or aimed at you know, people in Britain or Canada or whatever have you. That's one thing. The other thing as well is that they're clearly state run. I mean, their boss was recently fired by Trump, isn't that right? And replaced. He was complaining about it. I forget his name. Jamie Fly. He was fired by the Trump, I was going to say regime, the Trump administration. Okay, so sorry. So but what I mean is that they're clearly state run, at least at the top level anyway. And RT management is obviously state appointed as well. I mean, Maria Simonian was appointed by the Kremlin, obviously. And I just don't like the idea that RT is targeted, like, you know, Russian affiliated media or whatever, Russian government affiliated media, and smeared that, you know, it's like Kremlin propaganda, and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty gets a free pass on that. That's just what I find, the double standard. And by the way, I read some things on Radio Liberty's website. They've got some good reporters, I agree. They do write some good articles sometimes. It's just the double standard that annoys me, that it's like, oh, we can have state media, but you can't, to the Russians. And there's some idea like that, you know, RT is like propaganda. I mean, I can only speak about my own work. Like, we cover Russia straight. We cover it objectively. We run critical and positive articles. We basically cover everything. I mean, I think we've given more coverage to the Navalny poison than the Moscow Times has, to be quite honest with you. You know, and like, I just feel that there's this kind of double standard that, you know, they're seen as the good guys and we're seen as the bad guys. And that's what I don't like. And that's why I have a go at Radio Liberty quite a lot. It's not because I have anything personally against people that work there or anything. It's just the concept that that organization is seen as holier than thou. And also, you might remember, Kevin, a few years ago, I can't remember the guy's name right now, but they fired a prominent journalist in 2014, one of their editors, because he supported the Donbass thing. Remember, he objected to the Ukraine stance on Donbass. So, like, I mean, they have fired people for political reasons in Radio Free Europe. It's not, you know, for not towing the line. I mean, I can't remember the guy's name. I think it was Stanislav something. So that's all I wanted to say. Like, there's an idea that they're not politically controlled. They clearly are politically controlled. You can disagree with that, of course.
What are your favorite news sources in Russia? Because I know it's not Radio Liberty or Radio Svoboda, but like what do you turn to for kind of like when you begin your day to see what's cooking in Russia? Like, what are some of your first stops?
I get all my news online, like probably you do nowadays. I don't really watch TV. So basically, the first websites I'd look at in the morning, I think the best Russian news outlet is Kommersant. That's what I think. It's still independent without being, you know, pro this or anti this. I think RBK is a very good publication, the business publication. I still read Novaya Gazeta, by the way. I think it still does a lot of good work. Novaya's kind of been forgotten about, do you find? I don't know. I think because of your work at Medusa, Medusa's overshadowing Novaya nowadays, no?
Hopefully.
Nobody talks about it anymore. No, Novaya. I still read that. I do read Medusa sometimes, by the way. But the first, I would go to them. Also, I think Znak is a very good outlet from Yekaterinburg. Do you ever read that?
Yeah. Although my faith in them was a bit shaken after the Magnitogorsk apartment complex explosion. Because as far as I recall, they really ran with very conspiratorial, which still may or may not be true. I don't remember, but like. They ran hard with the notion that it was a terrorist attack and there was this shootout afterwards and that a big cover up, and I don't, that seemed to me to be rather unsubstantiated, and so I don't know, like that's kind of shaken my faith in Znak a little bit. But I agree, they do definitely have a lot of interesting coverage, and they're not in Moscow, which is
nice. And Fontanka in St. Petersburg can be quite good as well. It's something I keep an eye on. But they'd be the main ones I'd go to. I obviously not reading I'm not reading BBC, but they'd be the main ones I go to. I really like Kommersant. I used to like Vedomosti, but a lot of people are getting upset about Vedomosti because of the takeover. But I actually think it's been in decline for a few years now, the last two or three years. It's news coverage in terms of like breaking news is effectively non-existent for the last 2 years, long before the takeover. It's become more like a sort of business magazine. Or do you find that? I don't know. Oh, by another publication I think is very underrated, and you can actually, I mean, you can laugh if you want, but I actually think that some of his Vestia stuff is quite good. I really do. I think especially some of their features.
Which, like, their feature stories, okay.
Yeah, I just do. I think, like, I think some of it's quite good. I really do. I think, especially, like, I was reading something this morning about some village going underwater or something. Just thought it was interesting. I can't remember. But, you know, but, like, you know, like, so they'd be the ones I'd mainly go to. I also think Echo has a lot of interesting stuff. Echo of Moscow. So, yeah, there you go. And I don't know, MK Rue is not so bad, but they'd be the ones I tend to go to. I also think TASS is quite a decent news wire. I think it's underrated sometimes. They're very fast with breaking news.
What do you think most Western journalists and Western analysts get wrong about Russia? You've already said that you feel they're too concentrated in Moscow, but in terms of their the kind of like mainstream, most accepted points of analysis and stories that you see reported in the Western media, what kind of irks you the most?
Okay. I'm going to put it like this to you. On Twitter, it probably sometimes comes across that I'm very hostile or anti to a lot of British or American journalists. That is not the case. It's not personal. I think one of the problems with coverage of Russia, Kevin, is that what you have working in Moscow are a lot of very intelligent, very well-educated guys who've gone to prestigious universities in many cases, Oxbridge or Ivy League in the States, and they are ambitious. They want to make it. Most of them are using Moscow as a stepping stone to, you know, go somewhere else eventually. I'm sure that's fair to say. And I think by virtue, that means that everything they do has to be an investigation, if you know what I mean. They're constantly investigating this and investigating that. And I think there's a lack of normal beat reporting on Russia. I know beat reporting is boring. I know that. And I know it's boring. I mean, I started with it myself for a number of years and it's boring. But there is a lack of beat reporting. And there's everything has to be have some kind of big revelation or a big reveal or big investigation or they're not happy. And I don't think people really read these articles. I think they're basically sharing them amongst themselves. I think you see so often on Twitter, somebody from the hack pack, as they call themselves, will go to say, for example, let's say, hypothetically, Voronezh, and write about a hospital or something which is crap on the outskirts of Voronezh or something. And they'll all share it, you know, like this amazing article by Kevin Rothrock, who went to the world's worst hospital and cleaned the toilets himself, you know, because he felt sorry for the janitor, you know, whatever. And they'll all share it themselves. But I think they're the only ones reading it. So the problem is sometimes I find that they're not writing for the public. They're writing for their fellow journalists. That's their audience, their target audience. And that's what irks me a little bit. And I find that I just find I'll give you an example. The other day, I saw on Twitter that you probably saw that tweet, Kevin, that the murder rate in Russia has fallen from in just 15 years by a factor of 4.5 times or something, or four times. And the murder rate in Russia has now converged with the United States.
That doesn't sound good.
Now, that's a story,
no one should be happy about that.
Yeah, but I understand it, but considering where it's coming from, you know, considering where it's coming from. Mm-hmm. But to me, that's a story. Like, I mean, if I had the time and the resources, I would love to go and investigate how that has happened or send somebody to do it. And hopefully if we get a few more reporters soon, I'll be able to do that. But the point is that they don't cover stuff like that. It's just, I just find the coverage is overwhelmingly negative all the time. I mean, it's like, I think somebody did a survey on it years ago and found that like 90% of coverage was negative or something. And like only 8% was neutral and 2% positive or something. And that's kind of what I feel, that you've got this group of super educated, super intelligent people, boys and girls, in Moscow. And I just feel that their audience is themselves rather than the wider public. And like, if you look at the Moscow Times, like, I think the two boys there, Evan and Pyotr, are really good guys. I think the newspaper has improved, it's not a newspaper anymore, website, has improved dramatically. But again, you know, a lot of the stuff is investigations focusing on hospitals. And I'd have to question, as a journalist myself, who really is interested in that outside of Russia, if you know what I mean. I'm not sure, basically, they're telling the stories about Russia that the wider public actually wants to read. That's what I mean. And that's just a bugbear of mine.
You don't think that Russians want to hear about the failings of their own medical system?
No, but Russians don't read English language media. They read Russian language media. So for example, if you write a story in the London Times, which incidentally is behind a paywall, or the Wall Street Journal, about a shitty hospital in Astrakhan or something, Russians are not going to read that. Like, it's just Westerners going, oh, look, they got really bad hospitals in Russia. Like, to make Westerners feel better about themselves. And by the way, Russian hospitals are actually not that bad, and they've improved dramatically in the decade that I've been here. Some of them are still diabolical, obviously, but they are slowly getting better. You know, what we're seeing at the moment in Russia now is a move towards private healthcare, which is a lot cheaper than the States. But some of the private hospitals are state-of-the-art, you know, and not that expensive. I mean, like, you're talking, like, $15 to $20 for an appointment, you know, with a specialist. But, you know, what would $20 buy you in the American medical system?
I don't know, like a burger at the commissary.
I'm not trying to be down. And by the way, contrary to what it might seem like, I actually am friends with some of the correspondents in Russia. And some of them I really have respect for. But I just find that it's too cliquey, and I find everybody gets too easily offended all the time. I mean, like, if somebody wants to have a go at me or criticize me, as far as I'm concerned, it comes with the territory. I don't block people unless they're particularly abusive, personally abusive. I would never block somebody for correcting me on social media. But I just find that people take things too personally. People, like, if somebody writes, for example, let's say on Twitter, that this has happened to me, by the way. Somebody has written that Russia, you know, wants to attack Estonia or something. I can't remember what it was. And I've replied back that in reality, if you talk to people in Moscow, serious people in Moscow, they say that they're not interested in Estonia. And you get blocked for that. And you get blocked for contradicting people, for correcting people. And I find that very, very unhealthy in discourse. I don't know why I'm talking about Twitter so much here. And, you know, and I just feel that the coverage itself is rather one note. That's all I feel. I mean, like, and sometimes deceptive. And I'm not saying, by the way, that they should go to Chechnya and ignore the human rights abuses and say, oh, I got a lovely pizza, you know, on Ulitsa Putina. Is it Ulitsa or Plashad Putina? They have in Grozny, I can't remember. They named one of the main boulevards after Putin. I don't know if you know that. But I'm not expecting that they should go there and say, you know, write about the beautiful pizzeria they found, or, you know, the great shashlik, you know, in Muhammad's bar or whatever. You know, I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying that I find the coverage excessively negative. That's all I'm saying.
Do you think there's anything that foreigners understand better than most Russians when doing journalism? Like, for example, most non-Americans probably understand better than Americans, I think, you know, how lack of universal health care is harmful. Like, when you have a foreign correspondent reporting from the United States, I would expect them to benefit from that kind of that perspective. Do you think that foreigners reporting...
I take your point, but the problem is how much of that reportage gets into the Russian ecosystem. That's the problem. I mean, like let's say, for example, Kevin, in the morning, I know you always say you're a translator, not a journalist, and I respect that, but let's just say for the sake of argument, you were hired in the morning by, let's say, the Washington Post and sent to Moscow as bureau chief, just for the sake of argument, okay?
Okay.
Let's just say for the sake of argument, okay?
Yeah.
I don't know who the bureau chief is there now. I know it was David Filipov a few years ago, but whatever. And you arrive in Moscow. Like, tell me honestly, how many Russians do you think are reading the Washington Post?
But they're not meant to, are they? I mean, the Washington Post is for their own, they have their own audience.
Yeah, so what I'm trying to say is that the correspondent, in my view, from the Washington Post, should be trying to explain Russia to American readers, not explain it to Russians. That's what I'm saying. And I think some of the reporters in Moscow have this almost evangelical desire to, like, speak the truth to power in Russia. But Russian power doesn't care about them. That's the problem. Russian power doesn't care. I mean, it's people like at Medusa who are speaking truth to Russian power, if you know what I mean, or at Novaya or Kommersant or Proekt or any of those places are the ones speaking truth to Russian power. And I just find that some of the foreign reporters here over kind of egg, you know, their importance in the media ecosystem here. I think another problem as well, and it's not their fault, is that news desks back home have a certain stereotype and a certain pigeonhole they want Russia to be in. And that's just how it is. So if I or you went to work for The Guardian, for example, in the morning, with the best of intentions, and the very unlikely event that The Guardian would want either of us, if we went there with the best of intentions, we can't just write whatever we want, obviously. We have to clear it with the news desk back in London and the foreign desk and whatever. And they obviously want a particular type of coverage. I mean, they obviously want, you know, liberals to be interviewed. You know, they want that perspective given. You have to speak to people like Hodorkovsky if you're working there. You have to, you know, use their kind of, you know, I suppose that, you know, stable of experts that Luke Harding built up, you know, when he was there in the mid 2000s. And that's a tough call as well, because, I mean, you're only on a salary. It's a tough world out there to get work at the moment, and you've got your own bosses to deal with. I understand that. And I understand that sometimes if I'm sniping at people or proceed to be sniping at people, that maybe they might feel that's not been taken into account, but it is. I mean, I know how it works. So that's what I'm trying to say like that. It's just, I'm not, like I said, I'm not asking them to write about, you know, they found this extraordinary flower shop, you know, in Magnitogorsk, but oh yeah, there was a bombing as well the same day, you know, for example, or a fire the same day or whatever. I'm not expecting to do that, but, you know, that's all I'm trying to say. And also, I think one other thing, Kevin, I think in some ways they're too hard on Russia. And I'll tell you why that is, because modern Russia is only 29 years old. And the country, the people who effectively run this country are all Soviet people. That's what they are. I mean, they are products of the Soviet Union. And, you know, I was never in the Soviet Union. You were never in the Soviet Union. I wasn't Transdniester once, so I have a pretty good idea what the Soviet Union was like, but I've never been in it myself. So you know, Tiraspol, but the point is that I just think that the coverage sometimes fails to take into account where Russia has come from. And I do think that the danger you see is that Western policymakers are reading all this stuff and it frames their attitude to Russia. And it creates a situation where, like, you see, for example, the sanctions right now that they're talking about over Navalny and the EU. I'm sure you follow this. Because the Western media has built this picture that Alexei Navalny is the leader of the Russian opposition, Kevin, I just feel that Western policymakers feel that Navalny's more important politically than he is in Russia. And I think that when they're looking at Navalny, so for example, if you're an MEP from a member of the European Parliament, for the benefit of American listeners, from let's say Portugal, and you're under the impression that, you know, that Russia has poisoned the opposition leader, you're looking at it, it's like Donald Trump poisoned Joe Biden or Nancy Pelosi, you know? I mean, that's what you're thinking. But the reality is that I'm not going to start calling him a 2% figure or a 3% figure or a 4% figure, but the fact is that there is no united opposition in Russia. And other opposition people have not chosen him to lead them. And that's another thing I wanted to get to. Sorry for this massive monologue. Another thing I wanted to get to as well is that I think the Western correspondents are too dismissive of the systemic parties in Russia. And the reason I say that is because, yes, I agree wholeheartedly that Zhirinovsky and Zhuganov are not serious independent political actors. There's no doubt about that. They've allowed the Kremlin to dominate their parties for the last 20 years. But at local level, some of these systemic parties are serious operations. I mean, like, as you saw in Khabarovsk, I mean, where Sergei Furgal, you know, for example. And like, I can say that the representatives in Krasnodar for the Communist Party and the LDPR and various other entities, they really believe in what they're doing. And they are, I mean, I've met doctrinaire communists down here, ideologically doctrinaire communists. And I think the systemic parties are dismissed completely in Western media coverage. I can't remember the last time. I don't think any Western outlet ever interviewed Pavel Grudinin when he was running for president, whether he was running or not, you can, you know, in taking part in the election, at least. Anyway, I can't remember the last time anybody from the Communist Party or the LDP or was interviewed by a Western media correspondent, the parties are completely dismissed. And the danger here, Kevin, you see, what I'm trying to get to here is that, let's just say, hypothetically speaking, that the whole deck of cards collapsed tomorrow morning, yeah? Let's just say that something catastrophic happened and the current Russian political system imploded. What's going to happen then is that policymakers in the United States are going to assume that Navalny is going to take over and his movement because he's supposed to be the opposition leader. But as you know, as an expert on Russia, the reality is that the parties that have the network on the ground across the country are United Russia, the Communist Party, and the LDP. They're the three parties. And if the system was to collapse, it is far more likely that some sort of nationalist using the infrastructure of the LDP or some, you know, revanchist communist using the KPRF structure is far more likely to come to power than a pro-Western liberal. And this is how it is. And I just feel that that's not taken into account. I think the coverage being so, where only liberals are basically given agency. Yasha Levine, who we know, described it, you know, as like Western, you know, that you know, he reckons the liberals are even worse than Putin, in his view. But, you know, it's a lot of it is, I think it was PR boosterism or something like that, you know, for them. But the point is that by only giving agency to people who are Western-leaning or favourable to the West's priorities in Russia, that you're misleading readers. That's just how I feel, okay? Now, you can feel free to disagree with that.
That's my interview with Brian McDonald, the head of the online Russia desk at the English language edition of Russia Today. Brian is very active on Twitter. If you'd like to follow him, please check the description of this podcast episode for a hyperlink to his account. If you enjoyed this interview and like listening to this podcast, please consider visiting patreon.com/KevinRothrock. I've got two membership tiers now, as they're called. For $10 a month, you can get a set of custom stickers displaying the show's artwork. Maybe that's your thing. Maybe you like stickers. Personally, I don't like stickers, but it was an option through the Patreon swag thing. And then for $20 a month, you can get something real. You can get a coffee mug with the podcast logo, an even specialer logo. In fact, it's an original sketch of the Russia guys, kind of what the logo is now. You get a sketch of what it looked like in the beginning. And it's a trek through time. Thank you to everyone already pitching in, and I'm happy to get feedback by email or Twitter, however you want to do it, if ever you have a comment or a question about the show. On the next episode of the show, I'll speak to Ben Aris, the founder and editor-in-chief at BNE IntelliNews. As always, thanks for listening. Until next time. Говорят мы пяки-буки, как выносит нас земля. Дайте что ли карты в руки, погадать на короля.